Sounds of things. It was a good Christmas season. We gathered just last week to talk about love and our final thoughts on Advent, and now here we are. And we have celebrated Christmas and the miracle that the Word became flesh and made His dwelling among us, and we are now just 2 days away from the new year. And I don't know what you think about when you think about New Year's and New Year's celebrations. My thoughts turn to lots of college football and time with my family. Some of you, however, you think about resolutions, and you know who you are. I am not much of a resolution person myself. I actually think they're important. I think they're valuable. I think it's really wise at the end of a year to take some time to do some self-evaluation and challenge ourselves for the year ahead. It's just that I'm really terrible at them. I typically have a resolution to remember my resolution by the time MLK weekend rolls around. I'm not really adept. Others of you, however, are hardcore resolutionaries, and you have been waiting all year to make major life changes. You think, sure, I know I should brush my teeth every day, but it's only August, and January, that will be one of my resolutions. I know somebody who toyed with the idea of making 13 resolutions for 2013, and that to me sounds crazy, so I'm going to offer us four this morning. Four for our pursuit of Christ as a church family in the new year, and they come from the book of Hebrews chapter 12. So open to Hebrews chapter 12, if you will. Many of the women in our church studied through the book of Hebrews during the fall term of the gathering. They sat under really great teaching from Bonnie Fear and from Joanne Herdrich. So if anything you hear from me today you don't like, just grab one of the women. They can do it better than me anyway. But Hebrews chapter 12. Not surprisingly, Hebrews chapter 12 follows on the heels of Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11 is a chapter dedicated to the Old Testament saints who lived lives of faith. And in it, the author tells us about Abel and Enoch and Noah and the patriarchs and the prophets and a host of others who lived lives of faithfulness to God in often costly and very tangible ways. And here in chapter 12, the author is going to turn a corner and make some practical applications to the Christian life in light of what chapter 11 has shown us. And so we're going to begin in verse 1. Read along with me, if you will. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. The word of the Lord. Our passage this morning begins with the word therefore, and it connects chapter 12, both logically and linguistically, back to chapter 11. The great cloud of witnesses that the author mentions here in 12:1 refers to those in chapter 11 who had lived these lives of faith. And the author contends that those lives matter to the way we live our lives, that they didn't live them on display simply for our entertainment, but rather they were examples of faith that were meant to encourage and motivate us as we live the Christian life. And this makes sense to us, I think, because I think each of us can think through our own life and think of somebody who lived a life of faith that encouraged us or motivated us. And in fact, we're going to share that with one another right now. And so I want to fill up the room, fill up the empty space, and I want to hear. Let's name the people who have lived lives of faithfulness that have motivated and encouraged us as we pursue Christ. Let's name them out loud. We could probably do this all day. the longer we stayed, the more and more you would think of people, and the more some of you would warm up and say, oh yeah, there was this person, that person motivated me, and this person motivated me and encouraged me. And that's the way that chapter 11 is to work in our lives, as well as those that on a daily basis are part of the great cloud of witnesses. They motivate us to greater holiness. And greater holiness is really the concern for the remainder of this passage that we're going to look at this morning. And so let's talk about four resolutions that will push us towards greater holiness in 2013. The first one is to strip. Yes, you heard and read that correctly. Look again at verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. The word translated as throw off literally means to get rid of things, to lay aside, to throw them away, anything that will hinder or entangle us. You might remember watching the Olympics this summer, and the sprinters, both male and female, they wore skin-tight racing suits, not for the ratings, but because it's hard to run in really baggy clothes. It's hard to run when you've got a lot of things around you that are unnecessary. And so they strip down as much as possible so that they can run well the race that is marked out for them. And I think this makes sense to us conceptually, but I want to demonstrate it, and I've recruited a little help. And so Blake LaBrie and Will Mundell are going to come up and help me. Gentlemen, now would be the time. Come on up. This is Will and Blake. Everybody say hi to Will and Blake. Wow. Can you say hi to them? That's polite. You're pretty confident. Okay, so here's the deal. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a real quick foot race. You're going to race on your feet. Does that make sense? That's why it's called a foot race. We're going to start right down here in front of the table. We're going to start right down there. And when I say go, let me tell you what the course is so you don't run the wrong way. You're going to head that way. You're going to turn. You're going to go right past Kelsey. Kelsey, can you wave your hands? You're going to go right past Kelsey. You're going to go up that aisle. You're going to go around the back. Then you're going to come right down this aisle over here. You see? Not the far by the windows, but the aisle right there. And then you're going to end up right back here. Does that make sense to you? Any questions? It's pretty straightforward. It's a foot race, right? Okay, great. Well, before you start, I have a couple modifications for you. So, Blake, I'm going to need you to take off your shoes, please, because you need to wear mine instead. So go ahead and slip these on, and please don't tie them. You might mess up the laces. You're also going to need to wear this backpack full of books. That would be helpful. Now, I'm aware that at the moment this doesn't seem fair, so you need to carry this empty coffee cup. And there we go. Okay, are we ready? You know what you're to do? It's pretty straightforward. Ready? Do you want to get next to him? You're going to need all the help you can get. Go. Come on, cheer them on, people. Blake, you're losing. Blake. Great job. Great job, both of you. Thank you. Thank you to both of you for being willing to embarrass yourselves in that manner. I'll take my shoes back. They won't fit you for roughly 7 years. Great. And we might think that's silly. You can sit down now, gentlemen. Thank you for your part. And that might seem like a silly illustration, and in some ways it is, but I think that that's exactly what some of us do when it comes to the Christian life. We gather things around us that actually just don't help us run well. There's nothing wrong in and of itself with a backpack full of books. In fact, many of those books are really good books, but they aren't going to help us run well. And I think we do that. We gather things around us, things that entangle, things that hinder, and we try to run our race of the Christian life as though we have a backpack full of books on our back. And you might be thinking, sure, that applies to those that have major unexamined sin in their lives. I'm sure the Christian life is really hard for them. And it probably is, but the author makes a really important distinction that ends up with us all lumped in together. Look again at verse 1. Notice, we are to throw off not only the sin that so easily entangles, but also everything that hinders. If a runner is in a race and her feet get entangled, she's going down and may not be able to finish that race. That is the nature of sin that entangles. It seeks to disqualify us from the race. But there are other things which may not entangle, but they don't help. They simply hinder us. They make it harder to run well. F.F. Bruce helps us to understand the difference when he says, there are many things which may be perfectly all right in their own way, but which hinder a competitor in the race of faith. They are weights which must be laid aside. But there are other things which are not perfectly all right in their own way, but are essentially wrong. There is sin which so readily ensnares us. I think that most of us know that we need to avoid sin that will entangle, things that are obviously wrong and run counter to God's will for his children, but how are we doing with things that hinder? How are we doing with things that don't benefit us and only serve to slow us down? A number of years ago when we were first married, Greta and I made a decision for a period of time to fast from R-rated movies. There was no real moral compulsion to do that. We just simply decided, that's kind of a hindrance. That doesn't help us. It doesn't help us be conformed into the image of Christ in ways that we want. And two really incredible things happened. The first was that we found ourselves resensitized to all of our entertainment. All of a sudden, by eliminating that hindrance, we were able to better analyze and evaluate things that we were looking at and able to say, is this helping me to be conformed into the image of Christ? The second really surprising thing that happened was that we faced a lot of misunderstanding. Other people didn't enjoy our laying aside of this hindrance. In fact, I was told by one person in no uncertain terms that we were making a silly and arbitrary choice and he would in no way follow suit. Now, mind you, we hadn't asked him to follow suit. But I think that by being willing to share what we perceived to be the benefits of laying aside this hindrance, he was somehow put off by that. We just simply wanted to run a better race. We simply wanted to be able to better pursue Christ and identified a hindrance and laid it aside. What about us in 2013? Are we willing? Are we willing to lay aside not only the sin that will entangle, but also the things that are going to hinder? Are we willing to do it even if it might be okay for others? Even if it's not a popular choice? Even if we face misunderstanding and it makes us stand out? We must. We must strip ourselves because we need to run. And that is our second resolution that we get out of this passage, is to run. Look again at verse 1. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. I can't tell you how much I wish this read, let us stroll at a leisurely pace the race marked out for us. Or even sprint a short distance would be preferable, but it doesn't. It says, let us run with perseverance. The picture here is more of a marathon or even an ultra marathon. The Christian life is a long run. The Greek word that is translated race here is the word agona. You hear the word agony there, and that's perfectly appropriate because that's exactly what running long distances is. It's agony. But the author can't pull punches here. The author can't avoid it because of chapter 11. Chapter 11 had all these examples, these bright, shining examples of lives of faith, and they were costly. Listen to what the author says about some of the faithful in chapter 11. They were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and in holes in the ground. And if that's what they faced, then can we be surprised that in chapter 12 such challenging language is used to describe our race, our Christian life? Anyone who would have you believe that the Christian life is smooth and free of complication and easy, and that when you come to Christ, everything just goes perfectly, well, that person simply hasn't read the New Testament. Instead, the New Testament describes the Christian life with words like battle, struggle, and race. Jesus himself in Luke 13:25 said, make every effort or strive to enter through the narrow door. The word that is translated make every effort or strive, it's the verb form of agona, the same word we have here. Paul tells Timothy to fight the good fight, literally agonidzu, the good agona, strive the good striving, fight the good fighting. When you came to Christ, you signed up for a long race, a struggle that demands perseverance. Aren't you so glad you came to church this morning? Feeling so good about things now? But it's true. And that's why we're called to strip ourselves of anything that will hinder or anything that will entangle us, because we have a long run ahead. The first two resolutions are related, and not just in theory, but also linguistically. Laying aside is what grammarians call a participle of attendant circumstance. And what that simply means is that it's a prerequisite for running well. If we really want to run well, if we want to run our race with perseverance, we have to lay aside things that are going to entangle and things that are going to hinder. So it matters how we dress, and it matters how we run, but it also matters where we look. And that brings us to our third resolution. Look at verses 2 and 3 with me again. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. It says, let us fix our eyes. The ESV says, looking to Jesus. But this is more than just a one-time glance. A couple of weeks ago, you might remember, we had popcorn between services, and one of our students brought a cup full of popcorn to youth group, to fifth and sixth grade youth group. When we went outside to play the game, we were headed right back here to the grass, and he set it on a table, and he said, hey, will you watch my cup of popcorn for me? And I said, sure. So he went down to play, and then he came back up the stairs, and he said, I'm just going to grab my cup of popcorn. And I said, oh, well, the wind blew it over, and it's scattered all over the ground. And he looked at me with this mixture of really despair and disdain, and he said, I thought you said you would watch it for me. And I said, I did. I watched it blow on the ground. Well, the looking and staring here in this passage is really different than that. This could be translated, keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus. This is not a one-time glance. This is more like if my wife said, can you watch our daughters while I go to the gym? I'd better understand that that's really different than the way I agreed to watch a cup of popcorn. Keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, and we stare at him, and we fix our gaze on him as we run this race, because he is the author and perfecter of our faith. Other translations say he's the pioneer. He's the founder of our faith. Christ went before us, and he established what it is that we are trying to do. F.F. Bruce helps again when he says this. Jesus, that is to say, is presented as the one who has blazed the trail of faith and as the one who himself ran the race of faith to its triumphant finish. The one who went before us shows us the way that we too are to go. If we want to know what a successful Christian race looks like, we stare at Jesus, because he ran his own race with perfection. And further, the passage tells us we're to consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Yes, the Christian life is a challenging race, and it requires discipline and perseverance. But when we're tempted to give up, we stare at Jesus. When the lab report comes back and it isn't in our favor, we stare at Jesus. When the path of faithfulness leads to misunderstanding and even persecution, we stare at Jesus. When we face another month of trying to decide which bills are going to go unpaid, we stare at Jesus. We stare at the one who faced everything we face and yet ran his race with perfection. And in so doing, our resolve and our hope is restored. By considering what he went through, we find strength to go on. A couple of years ago, my grandfather was vacationing in Palm Springs, and he wanted to have his own car, even though he doesn't drive at night, which means that somebody had to drive him home from Palm Springs to his home in Boise, Idaho. And so Greta and I got the real privilege of doing that, and they met us in Santa Barbara, and then we drove from Santa Barbara to Boise. And along the way, my grandfather began to open up and tell stories about something that he didn't often talk about, which was his time serving in the Army in World War II. And as we drove, from Santa Barbara to Boise, we heard story after story of what it was like for him serving in the European theater during World War II. And some of his stories were sad, some of them were very lighthearted. And as I listened, I found just an overwhelming sense of pride growing in me, thinking, this is my grandfather. It is a privilege to be related to him. But something else grew inside of me as well, which was a sense of almost obligation, thinking, does my life count in light of what he did? Does my life matter? Is it different because of what he endured? Well, more significantly and in a more sweeping way, Christ endured for our sake. He endured the cross and the opposition of sinful men so that we could have true and lasting spiritual freedom. And because of what he endured, we can stare at him when our race is long and challenging. We can look at him and consider what he went through. And in so doing, we can find our strength and our motivation. So we strip, we run, we stare, and finally, we fight. Verse 4 tells us that there is a battle to enter. Look at it again. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Now, if we're honest, that sounds a little crazy, right? Resisting sin to the point of shedding blood. That's maybe a little more than I bargained for. I don't know about you, but I feel sometimes as though I've made my peace with sin, that I'm willing to coddle it, accommodate it, tolerate it, make allowances for it. I do think it would be nice not to struggle with the same things over and over and face them year in and year out, but I don't really fight. Maybe that sounds familiar to you too. Verse 4 tells us that we are called to fight against our sin, to battle it. I have a 2.5-year-old named Gwen who loves more than anything to read. That is her favorite thing to do. In particular, she loves to read Curious George books. And we were reading a Curious George book recently, and I realized that I recognized the pattern of sin in the Curious George story. So if you'll indulge me, we're going to read for just a couple of moments. Now here's the setup. George has escaped from the zoo and is looking for his friend, the man with the yellow hat. Of course, he gets into trouble along the way, so a kind chef helps him to find a job. Now, why a monkey escaped from a zoo needs a job is beyond me, but that's okay. That's where the story goes. And watch what happens when George gets a job washing windows. Sure, I can use you, the elevator man said to George. I will give you what you need for the job. You can start right away. But remember, you are here for washing windows. Never mind what people inside the house are doing. Don't be curious, or you'll get into trouble. George promised to be good, but little monkeys sometimes forget. George was ready to start. My, how many windows there were. But George got ahead quickly, since he worked with all four hands. He jumped from window to window, just as he had once jumped from tree to tree in the African jungle. For a while, George stuck to his work and did not pay any attention to the people inside. Of course, he was curious, but he remembered his promise. In one room, a little boy was crying because he did not want to eat his spinach. George did not even look, but went right on with his work. In another room, a man was taking a nap and snoring. George was sorry it was not his friend, the man with the yellow hat. He listened to the funny noise for a while, then went on working. But what was going on in here? George stopped working and pressed his nose against the window. Two painters were working inside. George was fascinated. Painting looked like a lot more fun than washing windows. The painters were getting ready to go out for lunch. The minute they left, George climbed inside. What wonderful paints and brushes they had! George could not resist. An hour later, the painters came back. They opened the door and stood there with their mouths wide open. The whole room had changed into a jungle with palm trees all over the walls and a giraffe and two leopards and a zebra. And a little monkey was busy painting himself on one of the trees. Then the painters knew what had happened. Luckily, George was close to a door. He ran out as fast as he could. After him ran the two painters, then the elevator man, and then the woman who lived in the place. "Oh, my lovely room," cried the woman. "Don't let him get away." George headed for the fire escape. George reached the end of the fire escape. The others had not caught up with him yet. Here was his chance. They could not jump, but George could easily jump down and escape. In a moment, he would be safe. Poor little George. He had forgotten that the pavement was hard as stone, not like the soft grass of the jungle. Too bad. The fall broke his leg. We read only the best theological books in my home. But did you see it? Did you see the progress of sin there? Remember, at the outset, George was told, pay no attention to what's going on inside those windows. Just wash the window and move on. And at first, he did great. He didn't pay any attention. But then he allowed himself to listen at one window. And then he allowed himself just a quick glance. And then eventually, he forgot all about the instructions he was given. And he sat there and stared. And the next thing you know, he was covered in paint, crumbled beneath an overcrowded fire escape, howling in pain from a broken leg. I would say that sin works the same way in us that George's curiosity did in him. It began in the garden that way. Did God really say? Well, of course not, but now that you mention it, we can never envision ourselves running headlong down the path of sin until that's exactly where we are. And we look back at a series of little choices, little compromises, little accommodations, and wonder how we ended up somewhere so unimaginable. And what awaits us is far worse than a broken leg. God himself in Genesis 4 told Cain, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, to dominate you, or to master you. Peter writes that our enemy, Satan, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Sin wants to destroy and devour us, and it will, if we don't fight back with the power of the Holy Spirit. The root of the word struggle in verse 4 is our old friend agona. And the author also enlists resist, which means to set in opposition to it, have the connotation of lining up troops for battle against an opposing army. We are called to battle our sin, and we lose that battle when we tolerate it or accommodate it. We are called to fight. The Puritan John Owen wrote The Mortification of Sin, and in it he offers this classic quote. He says, the choicest believers who are assuredly freed from the condemning power of sin ought yet to make it their business all their days to mortify the indwelling power of sin. Do you mortify? Do you make it your daily work? Be always at it whilst you live. Cease not a day from this work. Be killing sin, or it will be killing you. Be killing sin, or it will be killing you. We have a fight ahead of us, but the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, and so we are thankful for the Holy Spirit and the reminder from John that the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. We need the Holy Spirit to convict us of ways that we have tolerated things that offend our holy God. We need the Holy Spirit to fight for us when we think we are going to crumble in the face of battle, in the face of trial. We need the Holy Spirit to shore up our defenses and to prep us for battle against an enemy who wants to devour us. We cannot wage this war on our own, but we do have everything we need to battle well. So in 2013, let's resolve to be a people who strip, run, stare, and fight. I know that this looks like the agenda for a frat boy's Friday night, but it's actually the path of holiness. This is the race marked out for us. And you might be left asking, why bother? It sounds kind of taxing. I mean, if Christ already forgave my sins, then why should I strain so much? Quite frankly, this is the only proper response to one who endured the cross and overcame death on our behalf. Jesus is our older brother, our example, and our inspiration. And as we stare at him and as we consider him, we will be better able to strip and to run and to fight. Our gratitude calls for such a life. We're going to spend a few moments responding to this teaching, and we're going to share together, we're going to encourage one another, we are going to be the great cloud of witnesses for one another right now as we think about ways that we can do this. And so Eric's going to come up and lead us.
In chapter 10 of Hebrews, The author says, let us consider how to stir one another up towards love and good deeds, and let us not neglect meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. And so this morning, we are going to encourage one another towards love and good deeds by sharing with one another. And specifically, I want us to share along the lines of our outline there that Benji taught us. And specifically, I want us to share along two lines. Either tell us something that you feel called or convicted to lay aside so that you can better run the race set before you, or maybe you want to give testimony to something that you already have laid aside that has freed you up to run more energetically and freely. Or encourage us and tell us what is one way that you have stared at Christ, that you have gazed at Christ, and tell us how that has encouraged you in this race.
Specifically,